Ah, God,
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Welcome to Northern Exposure, our big book study of Harley.
Woo!
We are so excited. I'd like to know how many people are from Anchorage are here tonight. Anchorageites. All right. How many from the Valley? Hoorah! How many are here from Homer? We are so happy to have you. How many are from Kotzebue? A lot of us are in small fellowships, and we do get well acquainted with each other's stories, and it's so cool to have new stories and experience strength and hope. To hear about your big book story and your story, so Harlan, please come on up. Welcome to Alaska.
Thank you. I was going to be here. Hi, I'm Harlan. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Harlan.
Probably couldn't have escaped that one. My mother was a compulsive overeater. My dad was too. My mom had no clue that she was even pregnant on the day that I was born. I was born in Chicago. It's part of my story. It's who I am. I know the sweatshirt says Oregon. That comes later. But I was born and raised in Chicago, and no doubt in my mind, the first sounds that I heard in my life were my mom and dad screaming and yelling at one another. When I was born in 1954, as I told you, my mother had no clue that she was pregnant. My father came to this country after the world had gone crazy, and every member of his family was obliterated off the face of the earth. And he lost his parents, grandparents, sisters, brothers, nieces, and nephews, some under the age of five. He lost everything and everyone that he knew and was cast upon a new country, did not speak one word of the language, had no idea how to live, and questioned why not. He didn't question why they were killed, he questioned why wasn't he killed too. And he just didn't understand it. And I think the only sense he could make of the murder and the mayhem that he saw. And murder and mayhem and that side of that smell of death was something that was very real to him. It was not something that he saw in a movie. It was not something that he heard about in a book. It was something that he lived firsthand. And the sounds and the smells and the everything made him question, where were you, God? Where were you? Where were you, human beings? Did you not see what was going on here? And so he was very angry, and he was very, very disenchanted with so much. And he was very quick to reassure me every single day of my life, from as far back as I can remember, that they are going to come and kill us one day. That one day they will come and kill us. And he somehow thought that by telling me this on a daily basis, that would somehow prepare me for the inevitable. Probably by the time I was 1 minute old, I was an out-of-control compulsive overeater. I am not one of these people that woke up one day when they were 20, 30, 40, and started having problems with food. Some of my very earliest memories of my life were finding a step stool and climbing up to the cabinets in my house and pulling cookies and pulling food down off the cabinets to eat when I was a toddler. And I remember very distinctly one time I was kind of like moving across the counter to get cookies, and I forgot that I had moved, and I fell, and they came in running and everything. My mother told me, my mother had mental illness. My mother was, as I said, she had no idea she was pregnant. My mother could be a child 1 minute, a raving lunatic the next minute, and then the next minute be the most knowledgeable, the most articulate, the most worldly person you'd ever talk to. You'd start wondering, maybe it was you that was crazy. And then she would just like breathe in and become a child or become a screaming, raving lunatic. And there was one thing that I also noticed from, and you know, as we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk about a lot of things this weekend. We're going to talk about some things this weekend that maybe you haven't talked about in OA before, but one of the things we are going to talk about tonight is we're going to talk about the doctor's opinion, because that's going to be the agenda tonight. I'm going to tell you my story, I'm going to tell you a little bit about me, and then maybe over the weekend I'll get to learn a little bit about you, and then what we're going to cover tonight is the very nature of this illness. But what I started to notice is in the doctor's opinion, and it says, our life becomes the only normal one to us. You know, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And for me, from the age of maybe 4 years old on, 3 years old on, my mother would tell me every single day of my life, I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you. And my father would come home and tell me, I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you. And every single day they would prove their hate for one another with pots and pans flying through the air and screaming and yelling. And I'll teach you a Yiddish word, gewaldes. Gewaldes is just major upheaval, fighting and screaming every single day. And all I really wanted to find out was if Huckleberry Hound was going to get away from Powerful Pierre this time, or if Yogi and Boo Boo were going to fool Ranger Smith and get away with the picnic baskets this time. And they're laying all this on me, and I'm like 4 years old. We can't pay the bills. I don't know what I'm going to do. What, blah, blah, blah. And there was one time in my family where every time there was massive quantities of food served, it was all quiet on the Western Front. The guns of Navarone were temporarily silenced, and all that you could hear was chewing, and all you could think about was the food. But food in my family was something that we ate constantly, and meals were just kind of punctuations between grazing. It was just like a punctuation. And I didn't realize, I don't know how we're going to do this, but okay. I didn't realize that not everybody ate that way until I got to be a little bit older and started going out to other people's houses. Food from the earliest time in my life had a very unnatural position in my life. And every single day from the time that I was a toddler, I thought about, in what I didn't know was an unnatural way, about obtaining food, eating food, hiding food, hiding myself to eat food, procuring food, and food became my entire obsession, my entire existence. Other people had, say, oh, we'd go out and play baseball. And they would eat just enough so that they could go out and play more baseball, because that was their agenda. I would play just enough baseball so that it looked good, and I had played enough baseball that I could go back and recreate with the food, because that was my agenda. That was my reason for being there. I would go to a birthday party and everybody would be playing games. I'd be fixated like a laser on the food. And as I got to be a little bit older and I kept wetting the bed and I kept doing all these other various things, the one thing that remained constant was this constant fixation with eating or not eating, eating or not eating. And that's something that, excuse me, that's something that I didn't realize wasn't because I lacked some modicum of willpower or character or strength. It was because I am afflicted with an illness that is a hopeless state of mind and body. And I can remember very distinctly as a child, maybe 3, 4 years old, 5 years old, people, my dad spoke very little English. Yiddish, yes. Russian, yes. Polish, yes. English, not so much. Not so much at all. And I would get so mad at him. He would say, thing, like, he couldn't say vegetables. He'd say vegetables. I said, Dad, it's not vegetables, it's vegetables. And his response was always, I never went to day camp mid a Superman lunchbox. And I couldn't figure out what going to camp, what a Superman lunchbox has to do with it. But in his mind, that just meant you're an American, and that's it. So you say it that way. Anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about that. Anyway. So I remember people yelling and screaming at my mother and father when I was a little kid. And then when I got to be about 5 or 6 years old, they started screaming directly at me. And I would look at these people, these men and these women and these other kids, and they would maybe be the parents of my friends, or they'd be, because I don't have cousins and aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters. I don't have any of that. But what we had was, he had a lot of friends, and a lot of the greenhorns that came over from the old country, they kind of banded together and made families, because there was a piece of a family there, there was a piece of family there, so we became mishpacha. Mishpacha is a Yiddish word for family, even though we didn't have the last name, the same lineage. And these people would start screaming right at me. And I was scared to death. And you know something? I'll tell you something, honestly. I don't know the answer to the question, mister, when I'm 5 and 6 and 20 and 30. I don't know the answer to the question of, why are you eating cake when you're so fat, young man? I don't know the answer to that question, even though I would lie, and even though I would try to say something just to get them away from me, because they were scaring me, and they were hurting my feelings, and I often would go and cry. But I always went off and ate. Because the only thing I knew to make this hurt go away, of being so ashamed of eating and so ashamed of getting screamed at and so embarrassed and hurt by being singled out, that the only thing I knew to do was to eat more Raisinets. And the eating of the Raisinets for about 20 seconds, maybe 10 seconds, made their ranting and raving go away. It made it okay. And it instantly made me feel like somehow I was giving them the finger, I was giving them the old Bafangu salute. Because I didn't like being told in front of a group of people that everybody gets chocolate milk, but I don't. Yes, I'm the only one that can't button my Little League uniform. And yes, I'm the only one that's fat. And yes, I'm the only one that needs to go on a diet. But yes, I'm the only one that's 7, and I don't want to be singled out that way. Nobody told me you have an illness. They didn't know themselves. And when I was 8 years old, I went to Dr. Jacobson on Milwaukee Avenue with my mother, and Dr. Jacobson screamed at my mother in Yiddish, and my mother screamed back at him in Yiddish, and I was on 500 milligrams of amphetamine 3 times a day, and I'm on 1,500 milligrams of amphetamine at age 8. I am not a fighter. I am an eater. I am a passive person. I am not a fist fighter. I've never been in a bar fight. I'm getting in fights at school, and I get accused of this now, but I would say the same thing 200 times, and I'm in my head going, Why do you keep saying that? They get it. It's raining out. Yes. And I can feel everything in my, like the temple here going ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And when the teacher would talk or when other people would talk to me, it just sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know, from the cartoon. Womp, womp, womp. That's what it would sound like. People would be talking to me, and I could see their lips moving, but I didn't know what the hell they were saying. My head was like on Jupiter, but I was over in Chicago, and I couldn't understand what was wrong with me. And, you know, you don't sleep for like 3 weeks. You know, and I'm 8 years old, and I don't know what to do, but I'm watching the late show until it's time to go to school. Homework, forget about it. I couldn't concentrate on anything, and I'm not eating. Hey, this is great. I'm losing weight. People are leaving me alone. Oh, but wait, the pills wear off. And when they do, I eat Illinois and most of Wisconsin. And then it's time to take another pill, so I stop. But in that time, I was 9 years old in 63 when Kennedy was killed. Right, okay. Yeah. So when I'm 9 years old now, some of the information is coming out that the amphetamines may not be so good for you, particularly if you're eight. We're just saying, if you're eight, maybe not so much. So, back to the doctor, and instead of pink pills, I'm on blue pills, a little less of a dose, but 4 times a day, not 3 times a day, no different results. Now I'm getting in fist fights, and I mean like all the time. And I cannot hear a word anybody is saying. I cannot hear what you're, I don't know what the hell you're talking about, and I'm losing weight. Any and every attempt that could have been made to lose weight, I took. And I think that there is something about the ego. We have to, or I have to, try every wrong answer out there before the right answer has any shot at permeating my massive, imbecilic ego. I mean, I tried lose weight with AIDS, the little not the illness, but the candies. I did. I was a Weight Watchers king. I was down at the Pitt Congress with this thing, and I lost 176 pounds, and I looked like Miss Illinois, and I did Tops. I went to Tops. Do you know from Tops? Some of the younger people are going, what the hell is he talking about? Okay. Lose weight with AIDS and Tops. Weight Watchers still around, but some of this stuff is beyond you. Metrical, who remembers Metrical, the cans of chocolate shake that you drink, and if one was good, 4 was better. Let's see. And there was, the diet gum and the diet candy that made you pass gas like you were a nuclear weapon. And, there was lots of good stuff. Lots of good stuff. Teenage years for a fat boy are massive pain because you have those feelings. I didn't go on my first date with a girl till I was 35 years old. Good thing I didn't know that then. I probably would have killed myself. But now I'm single again. I can't buy a date. No, I probably could buy one. But anyway, so I am now like 13 and 14. And you know when you hear like people that went in the 60s, I grew up in the 60s. If you remember anything, you weren't really there. I was there. I remember everything. Nothing got by me. I remember the pain. I remember all of it. But what I remember is how hollow that do-your-own-thing, march-to-the-tune-of-your-own-drummer was. We all wanted to be just like everybody else. I don't know if that's a girl thing, but guys, we just want to be like everybody else. That's a malarkey. And I wanted to wear Levi's and a Madras shirt. Again, the younger people are going, what the hell? What's a Madras? A mattress? No, not mattress. Madras. It was like a bleeding Madras. You don't know. All right, doesn't matter. Trust me, it was cool. You'll have to just... older people... tell the others when we're done. Okay. Just clue the others in. The Holy Roman Empire, neither holy nor Roman, discuss. Okay, now. I wanted to wear Levi's and wear a Madras shirt. I got jeans on. I always wear jeans to the retreats because I know I'm going to talk about this. And I just wanted to look like the other guys. I had to wear clothes that went out of style before World War II started. And I often, because there was no such thing as big and tall stores at that time. There was no such concept. I had to wear clothes that came out of Albany Park, out of an old clothing store for old, doddering Jewish guys, and my clothes went out of style at the end of the Great Depression. And I had shirts that went out of style, and I had all these other things, because if it fit, I had to wear it. There are no choices like that. And I don't care what they try to sell you. When you're 335 pounds, as I was as a senior in high school, the clothes don't go on you like they go on little Joe Cartwright. They just don't. What was the guy's name that played with Landon, Michael Landon. The clothes, that's it, Michael Landon. Yeah, he was Jewish too, by the way. Anyway, so bottom line is, the clothes, they don't look the same, okay? And my friends were wearing the skin-tight trimsters and the thing, and no way. And sometimes I would really get unfortunate where the only clothes that would fit me would be like there'd be 3-4 pair of pants, and they'd all be the same color and the same size. So it looked like I was wearing the same pants for like a year or two. But anyway, it's hard. You want to look good. You want to look good for the girls. You want to be somebody that when you look, they look back. And I couldn't connect with that. I never went to the homecoming. I never did the things, you know, that boys do. I never did any of that stuff until way later. I was always lost in that area because I didn't go through that stuff. So still I'm lost. Anyway, I'm newly single again. But anyway, the bottom line is that, you know, these things started to really weigh on me. Now, here's another thing that was kind of happening in my life, too. I started getting, from a childhood on, very jealous. We're going to talk a lot about this on Sunday when we get to steps 8 and 9. And by then, we'll be crying, and we'll be hugging, and we'll be on the whole. It's going to get awful messy in here. But anyway, so I wanted Rob and Laura Petrie. And I got Max and Virginia Grabowski, something very different. And my dad was 72 years old when I graduated high school. My father was 72. My father was not one generation older than me. He was older than many of the grandparents of my friends. My father if I was 18, how much is 18 minus 72? So he was 54 years old right when I was born. So he could have easily been my grandfather, and many, many people thought that he was. Sometimes people would say, Max, is that your grandson? No, that's my nizun, means that's my son. And so he was starting to really break down. Now, my mother was not equipped to live in this world. She wanted to die. Her greatest ambition was to become an invalid and die. And she really wanted it bad. And she worked at it every day. She was a diabetic. Wow. And she would eat the whole cake, the whole pie. She had it at the end of her life. She was really breaking down. Is it hot in here or is it me? Anyway, okay, it's me. All right, okay. I thought maybe coming from Arizona, I'd be freezing my patooties off, and I'm not. I don't know why. But anyway, thanks. Bottom line is that she started breaking down. She was one of the people in 1976 that was on dialysis, when dialysis was a very different thing then than it is today. And the shunt would get infected, and it was not a she was an amputee from diabetes at the end of her life. And when I was 22 years old, she finally died. And when I was 24 years old, a year and a half after my mother died, my father died. And this is when I really started to go into the ionosphere in the illness, because I had nobody. I had nothing. I was ill-equipped. I had no money. I had no house. I was still living in the apartment. But a lot of my friends had trust funds and inheritances and houses that they inherited and families and all this other stuff. And I didn't have any of that stuff. And my spending was getting out of hand. And I'm writing bad checks to anyone stupid enough to take them. My food habit at that time, not my cocaine habit, not my heroin habit, was about $100 to $150 a day. And I'm not making anywhere near that amount of money. My weight at that time was about 500 pounds, maybe 575, 600 pounds. I really can't work. I can't focus on anything. I am living in filth. I am living in squalor. I am living in poverty. I'm writing bad checks. I'm not paying my taxes. I'm not paying any type of bills whatsoever. I am living in a fog. I've had my car repossessed twice at that time. I am one step ahead of the feds, the state of Illinois, what have you. I am living in a fantasy land with my head in the sand, thinking that I'm just not going to pay bills and that somehow that's going to be okay. And I am not owning up to my responsibility as a human being. And about an hour or 2 hours before my father died, he said to me, "My zun," which means my son. The fressen, the eating, was Dina Balakovsky. The Balakovskys were the ones that came and rounded you up to be killed. Okay, we're going to kill you. Let's everybody get together, get out of your house, pack your bags, do your thing. They're going to make sure you're all together because they know this group here is going to be killed. So he said, the food was your Balakovsky. It came and got you and took you away from us. The food came into my life and it took my son. He said, when you were a boy, I saw things in you that I could think maybe one day you would be president of the United States or one day you would be the governor of Illinois, and food just came. Find a way not to eat so much food. About a year before that period of time, my mother came out of a coma to tell me lucidly, "My son, food, don't let it kill you like it's killing me. Find a way not to eat so much. Find a way to stay on your diet." And not long after that, maybe a couple hours, she was dead. And my father died maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours. He had that conversation with me at 10 o'clock at night, and at 11:45 at night, that day, he died. So independently of one another, they're having this conversation with me that is identically scripted, one from the mother, my dad's not there, one from the father, my mother was already dead. They're having this conversation with me, and I do not underestimate their power with the Almighty, because my dad died in 1978, in November, and in February of 1979, just weeks after this occurred, two very dear friends pushed their way past the pizza boxes, past the Raisinette boxes, past the filthy, dirty, stinking garbage, and they came into my home and they said, "You owe us a lot of money and we love you and you're coming with us to this meeting that we heard about at the Orchard Mental Health Center in Skokie." Skokie is a suburb of Chicago, just like, where are we?
Anchorage.
No, we're not in Anchorage, are we?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. Well, there's...
Hillside.
All right, Wasilla, that's where you live. Okay. We never heard of that place until, you know, the whole thing here. All right, but anyway, now we know. Now we, like, we think we know everybody there, right? Because we see them on CNN and that. Okay, anyway. All right. Okay. So I go to this meeting, and I didn't want to be there. I wasn't exactly a willing participant. I came into that room, and that room in 1979, except for the religion of the people, didn't look very different from what I see tonight. I saw a bunch of housewives, and they looked thin. and they looked like they had Cadillacs, and they looked like they had their bills paid, and they looked like they had been to the hairdresser, and they looked very good in their dresses and their jewelry and everything. And I said to myself, no, I don't belong here. No. I may be a compulsive overeater, but what the hell are you doing here? See, a lot of people come in, they think they're well and worse, everybody else is crazy. I came in thinking, I'm crazy, and what are you guys doing here? I didn't want to be there. And I ate my way to the meetings. I prayed for a Russian airstrike during the meetings, and I would eat my way home. It wasn't exactly a fireball of willingness. But I had to go because I owed these guys money. And they were going to cut me off if I didn't go to these meetings. And so I went, oh, man. And I'm coming in there, and I stink. I mean, what I smelled like, the body odor that I had. Because at this time in my life, and you know, you don't have to be 700 pounds to get into this type of situation. But here is how far life had gotten away from me in those early days with this illness. I couldn't wear underwear. I had towels tucked in between layers of flab to keep the skin from rubbing up against each other, because that contact dermatitis was like somebody hitting me with a branding iron. My skin was red and angry, and my skin, the searing pain was unbelievable. I couldn't lay flat and breathe because I couldn't suck air out of the atmosphere if I was laying on my back. There was too much fat on my chest. And so I had to sleep sitting up in a chair, which meant that the edema, the swelling in my ankles, produced dime and penny sized ulcers where the pus would run out, and I couldn't wear socks because the swelling in my ankles was so profuse that the sock would cut into the skin. I couldn't get them on and I couldn't get them off. I had one pair of pants, I had a couple of shirts, all worn out here, cigarette burns, food stains, and I'm walking around going, where are the girls? Where are the girls? And how come they won't go out with me? So now I stink. I'm roughly the weight of some of the exhibits at SeaWorld, and I'm coming into these meetings thinking, you guys are crazy, but I'm okay. You know, you can't go to the movies. You can't fit in the seat. I broke furniture. I broke a lot of furniture. Oh, that's always beautiful. Breaking someone's couch, breaking someone's chair, I got stuck in cars. I had to drive everywhere. My upholstery in my car was broken. My seat was broken. I had the shiniest steering wheel in the country because it would rub up against my stomach, and my steering wheel never had a speck of dirt on it. And they made steering wheels out of soybeans in those days, and I'd have a black line on my pants from where the steering wheel would rub off on my clothing. It was a wonderful existence. It really was. I don't know why I gave it up. If I did to you what this illness did to me, I would be in a prison for a long time. Because no human being should be ever allowed to do to another human being what this illness did to me. There is no hell to escape from the pain of the food at that level. I couldn't go to the bathroom without a wall to clean myself against, to lean on and clean myself. I couldn't pee without some way of bolstering myself. I would piss all over myself often. No human being should live that way. No human being should live that way. And I knew in my heart that I was doing it to myself. And like my mother, I wanted to die. I didn't see any point. What's the point of this? There's no way out. I know I'm going to these meetings. This is bullshit. It ain't going to work for me. Nothing's going to work for me. I'm just going to die in the food. And I wanted to die like my mother. Tomorrow morning, we're going to read Bill's story. And one of the reasons I came to Alaska is to make it more your story than just some guy that you'll never meet, or maybe a guy that you see a movie about. But we're going to read about how he was going to get good and drunk this time, and he pounded on the bar wondering how it was happening, and he was going to get good and drunk this time, and he did. And the more I tried to fight that food, and the more I tried to resist it on unaided willpower, the more to it I was drawn, because I had no other way. In the pain of the food, in the muck of the food, in the mire of the food, the only thing that worked to cut the pain was the food. And so the very thing that was killing me was the thing I sought out, because it was all I knew. It was all I knew. Between the loneliness and the fear and the anger and the hopelessness, all I knew was to stand in front of the refrigerator with the light shining in my face, wondering, I'm so sick from eating, what can I eat to make myself feel better? No sane person does that, but that's exactly what I was doing. And so, I was insane. And in 1979 I came in, but by 1982 I had graduated, and I was out there, and I heard the graduation ceremony. You all know the graduation ceremony. If you've graduated, welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? That is the graduation ceremony from Overeaters Anonymous. And the graduate resoundingly responds, yes, and supersize the fries. And that's the graduation ceremony, and many of you have attended your own. They're always private, but there's nothing as good. I don't like much in my illness as good as a well-catered pity party, and that's just what that is. And so by 1983, I am really sick this time from eating. I'm really sick, and I'm well over 500 pounds. And I go into Skokie Valley Hospital, and my fever is 104. And they told me that if I reached 108, that I would die. And I've got dime and penny size ulcers in my legs. And I go to the hospital, and they tell me I have rampant cellulitis and staph infection, and that it's viral, it is not bacterial, and there may be something they can do, they'll try, but my left leg looks pre-gangrenous, they may have to amputate it, and my right leg doesn't look much better. Now I'm sitting there, and they had to send someone up from the shop to secure the bed, because all hospital beds are on wheels. And they didn't want to put me at that weight on a hospital bed for fear that it would just roll right into the wall and hurt the wall or hurt the bed. So they sent people up from the shop to secure the bed so that when I sat on it, it wouldn't roll. And I got on the bed, and I was sitting on the bed. I remember this very well. I'm running a fever. I'm delirious from fever. And I can remember this, the hospital gown. It looked like a faded blue tie. I had a set of knockers. Most girls. And this thing is like here. And the rest of me is like Jabba the Hutt here. And I'm sitting on the bed, and I'm crying. Oh my God, they're going to cut my leg off. Please let me die, or if you're going to let me live, show me how. I don't know. And I prayed our prayer, God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. And I came into that hospital. It was a Tuesday. And a couple of days later, A nurse at 11 o'clock at night came into my room and said, 99, your fever is going down. Just to show you how sick I was, physically and mentally, they kept me in that hospital for 15 days. You know how sick you got to be in a hospital for 15 days? You got to be plenty damn sick. Now, I'm in this hospital, and I am swearing to God, please, God, I will never eat like this again, and I will never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one. God, get me out of that one. And they did the same thing to me, for me, that they do when anybody comes in there, and one of the diagnoses is morbid obesity. I was 513 pounds when I registered in the hospital, and I remember they wrote down on my chart 513, and they said, this is not a mistake, this man is huge. And my friends came in and told me what it said, because I couldn't read it, because they were thinking if they wrote 513, people would think that that was a mistake. they wanted to be sure, that they did, that it was not a, that it was not a mistake. So, they send up their army of helpers. First, they send up the 91-pound psychiatrist. She came into my room, and as God is my judge, may the Chicago Bears never win another game if I'm lying. She told me, keep a picture of something you really like on the refrigerator, and when you see this picture, you won't eat so much. I says, honey, where have you been? Where have you been my whole life? Nobody told me this? Where the hell have you been? Now, the nutritionist comes up, and she's about 91 pounds, but to even her out, they gave her a heavy pen so she could kind of walk. She was 91 pounds. But in Chicago, it gets very windy. That's not why it's called the Windy City, but we'll get into that another time. But she wanted to make sure that if a wind came, she didn't blow over the goalpost at Wrigley Field. So she comes up to my room. Yes, the Bears used to play at Wrigley Field when I was a kid. Now they play at Soldier Field. But, okay, she comes up to my room and says to me, no dessert. And when you're served food, just eat half. I said, honey. I says, where have you been? I says, and you're just a nutritionist? I says, you should be running this place. This is crazy. This is nuts. And yeah, I'm pulling her chain. She don't know it. I'm pulling her chain. I'm telling her how brilliant. That's fantastic. Now comes the regular doctor. And this guy says to me, whatever you're served, just eat half. I says, no wonder you're a doctor and I'm not. I says, where do you guys, I mean, you guys are, why don't you put this in a book? Why don't you go on television? Hire skywriters. What is wrong with you? What are you keeping all this under wrap for? I walked out of that hospital 15 days later. I was 463 pounds, and I felt like Twiggy. Oh, I was so svelte. It was murderously cold. This is April. If you have not used your air conditioner and your heater in the same day in April in Chicago, you've never lived there. You've never lived there. In April in Chicago, you could get a 60-degree day followed by a 30-degree day, followed by a 60-degree day, followed by a 20-degree day. You never know. April is a crapshoot. May's not much better either. Oh, so where am I going? Okay, so I get in the car. There's now one of the most beautiful side effects of morbid obesity is the fissures on the bottom of your feet where the skin cracks. It's really beautiful. It sort of feels like somebody's testing power tools on your foot. So I'm going to the car, and it's ice, and my skin is cracking, and I'm walking out of the hospital. Now, I've just been in there for 15 days. I weigh now 468, and I'm going to the car. Now, after everything that I've been through, you would think that, hey, he gets it now, right? I get in the car after everything. I had a 10 and 2 fives. Start the car, it started, thank you, God. I get in the car. I put $3 worth of gas and $17 worth of binge foods. Later, I'm off to the races, and I don't come up for air till 1986. 1986, I come back at about 700 pounds. Life is no better. I'm breaking more furniture, and I'm breaking more world records for eating. And I should get a gold tablet from Sara Lee and Little Debbie and Oreos and all the rest of it. And I come back, and I had been through OA before once, but this time I saw some things I had never seen before. And this time I was conceiving of some things I had never conceived of before. And we're going to be talking about all of those things, and then we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and do the doctor's opinion. But we're not going to take it yet, so don't get excited. Okay. Okay, I'm just telling you what's coming here because I don't want you to get bored thinking I'm going to keep you all night here. I'm not. Okay, I saw some things, and I was ready to see them. Like on page 58, I saw step zero, the Aberdeen Proving Ground, ground zero, step zero. It says on page 58, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. I had never been really ready before. I was here to show other people that they were wrong or right or something, but I wasn't here for me. I wasn't here to try to recover. I wasn't here because I really, really wanted to do this. Now, we're going to be saying this, and I'm going to be saying this, and you're going to be hearing this a lot this weekend, but this is the very first time I'm going to say it to you, so it's going to be a first. I found out that this is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. And in order to do it, you must want to. And if you don't want to, we can't make you. Don't call me next Thursday and tell me about your nephew who's 300 pounds and what can I do for him? Nothing. I can recover. And I can read chapter 7 just like you can, and I can show him my recovery, and that's what we can do for him. But until you or the man in the moon is ready to take action, there is nothing any of us can do for any of us. We're going to be hearing that a lot this weekend. It's one of my mantras, so get used to it, okay? Now, I saw some other things, too, that I had never really seen before, and what I saw was extremely important, that the big book, which I believe was written by God, and we're going to be talking about that, because the human beings who put pen to paper didn't know enough to write it. They were not qualified to write one of arguably two of the most greatest spiritual pieces of literature in all the world's history because they had no background with which to pen such a masterpiece. So vital is this book and so important is the instructions in the book that it is, to date, in the 7,000-year history of addiction, the one thing that has worked to results that eclipses all other methods combined. It says in the foreword to the first edition, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And on page 45, the thesis line in the big book, it says the main object of this book is to show other alcoholics the main object of this book is to show other alcoholics, hold on a second because my brain, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. The main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And that means we're going to be talking this weekend about the differences between dieting with group support, which is what a lot of people in OA are doing. They're here and they're on a diet and they're going to read some of the crap and some of the other stuff. And they're going to stick to a diet, and they're going to stick to a food plan on unaided willpower, and we're going to be talking about the difference between that and what they're talking about is having a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Having a spiritual awakening as the result of working all the steps, all the time. And we're going to break that down and show how easy that is. And we're going to smash some of the myths of the two most misunderstood steps, 3 and 4. But in order for me to have what they're talking about, I have to want to, I have to take action. And on page XX, it tells me some things I really need to know here. On page XX, it says, and that's in the foreword, I believe, to the second edition, it tells me that of the alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, really trying doesn't mean they hunkered down and stayed on their diet. Really tried means they worked the program out of the book. Thank God they didn't have some of the garbage literature that we had now then. Thank God, because we wouldn't have a path to follow. of the alcoholics who really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about two or three, began to return as time passes. I have done these big book retreats in most of the states in this union. I've done them in Florida. I've done them in North Carolina, Montana twice, Ohio. I've done them in Kentucky. I've done them in New Orleans, Louisiana. I've done them in Little Rock, Arkansas. I've done them in Wisconsin. I've done them, well, many in Chicago or Illinois. I've done them in Arizona. I've done them in Nevada. I've done many in California. Some of you have heard my stuff on the podcast that I've done in California. I've spoken in, I'm going to Oregon next March. I have been in many, many different states in this union. I have been to OA meetings and conventions in Maryland, and I've been to many places. Now, by this, their recovery rate was 75%. I have just got through telling you that I've been to OA meetings in many different states. We can't talk about 75% in Arizona. I bet you can't talk about 75% up here in Alaska. We can't talk about 75% in California, Nevada, Wyoming, Oregon, Montana. We are lucky on a national, international basis if we can talk about 1.5% recovery rate in the face of the most vicious epidemic the world has ever seen of obesity. We are recovering at about 1 to 1.5%. Look around you. There's 28 people here, 30 people in this room, whatever there is. If you took a poll, go through here, go out the other side, go see who needs this program, knock on doors, there should be 28,000. Because you're here, you're willing to carry that message, that's what we're going to maximize on. What's the difference between those high numbers and the numbers we see today? People working the steps out of the big book and not getting distracted with other garbage. And we're going to be talking about that this weekend. We're going to be talking about what made them recover and what dilutes the recovery we have today. Now, we're going to break here in a second, but I also noticed something else that was very hard for me. They're talking about God. We're going to talk about why we need God. We're going to talk about why we need a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps and how that differs from dieting. But one of the things I had to learn was to set aside my BS about God. God didn't bring me a Playboy bunny, and God didn't bring me a Corvette, and God didn't bring me Robin Laura Petrie, and God didn't bring me this, and he didn't bring me that, so screw him. Well, I had to learn something. I had to learn the two things I need to know about God so that I can live in this world until I die. And these are the only two things. There's philosophers and there's theologians and there's clergymen, clergywomen that are out there, and they're going to decipher what God is and what God isn't. That, who cares? There's two things I need to know about God. There is one, and it's not me. And those are the two things I need to know about God right now. There is one, and it's not me. So we're going to be talking about that because that's why I'm here. And if you've heard me on the podcast, this is very much a part of who I am. We are going to talk about how God gets in between your mental twist and your physical allergy and makes your mental twist ineffective to triggering the physical allergy so that you don't have to fight food anymore. And the very fact that I've lost 500 pounds and I have 13 years of abstinence, yes, I did go in and out, is not the issue. The issue is I gave this disease decades of my life. I'm not giving it one more minute.